You're listening to a History Hub podcast. History Hub is based at the School of History at University College Dublin. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, and SoundCloud. For more information and to listen to hundreds of podcasts, go to historyhub.ie. In this episode, Professor Jessica Meyer from the University of Leeds will give a keynote lecture entitled Returning to Health: The Legacy of British Disabled Ex-Servicemen of the First World War. This paper was recorded at the Military Welfare History Network's 2025-2026 Military Communities Medical Welfare and Care History Conference Series, a series of three symposiums which were kindly supported by the Wellcome Trust through the Society for the Social History of Medicine and hosted by both the UCD Centre for War Studies and the University of Birmingham.
Professor Jessica Meyer, Professor of British British and Social and Cultural History at University of Leeds. Her research interests lie in the intersections of history, gender, medicine, disability and, of course, warfare, with a particular specialisation on the First World War and its social and cultural legacies. She's published at least has two books to date with Men of War, Masculinities of the First World War, done by Palgrave in 2009, which most of us are very familiar with, and An Equal Burden, The Men of the Royal Army Medical Corps in the First World War with Oxford in 2019, as well as numerous articles, books and chapters again, which we're all very familiar with. She's currently working on two book projects, The Return of the Soldier, An Intimate History of Demobilisation in Britain in the First World War, and Men and War, Modern History. So she co-presents the Oh What a Lovely podcast with Dr. Chris Kempshall and Angus Wallace, which is... So there's another podcaster in the room. And of course, as we see her paper today and a wonderful second keynote, Returning to Health, The Legacy of British Disabled Ex-Servicemen in the First World War. Over to you, Jessica.
So thank you, Paul and Michael, for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here. Like Donald, I'm going to take the opportunity of a small and friendly audience to put out some ideas which are at the beginning of their inception. Paul will be relieved to hear that my talk today is actually the germ of one of the chapters of The Return of the Soldier, this book that I'm working on, looking at the impact of the 4.5 million British servicemen who didn't die in the First World War, and how their return home shaped British society. This chapter is going to be called Returning to Health, and we'll look at both what happens in the war period and what happens after the foundation of the NHS to men returning with more attributable and not necessarily attributable health conditions following service. Today's paper is going to focus on the first half and think a little bit about men's return to health in the immediate aftermath of the First World War. So in their 1940 Social History of Britain Between the Wars, The Long Weekend, Robert Graves and Alan Hodge wrote that everyone who had served in the trenches for as much as 5 months or who had been under 2 or 3 rolling artillery barrages was an invalid. Shell shock, from which all suffered to a greater or less degree, was credibly explained as a morbid condition of the blood due to the stimulation of the thyroid gland by noise and fear. Its effects passed off very gradually. In most cases, the blood was not running pure again for 4 or 5 years. So, well, this is by no means any sort of officially recognised diagnosis of shell shock. They're social historians, not medical historians. And one that doesn't account for the many men who suffered from wounds and illnesses rather than various forms of psychological trauma. It does reflect the fact that the legacy of war service on the health of former servicemen was recognised as part of the challenges of the demobilisation and social reintegration of these men after the war, almost immediately. This recognition was not necessarily official and certainly was not comprehensive. Female nurses, colonial servicemen, as we've been hearing, and particularly the range of auxiliary personnel, struggled to gain any sort of equivalent recognition from society for compromised health attributable to war service. Those suffering from invisible impairments such as deafness or ambiguous etiologies, which included psychological traumas, and post-illness debility faced similar hurdles in trying to have their conditions acknowledged as relevant to their war service, in spite of Graves and Hodges' assertion. However, for all that war creates damage, and you know, the main purpose of war is injury and killing, the health implications of war service were not solely negative. And this is a point that Jay Winters made in terms of the civilian population, but it also applies to servicemen. Servicemen in wartime had been prioritized for nutritional provision by the state, and for many working class servicemen, that meant more calories, more food than they would have received and they would have had access to in civil life. And medical care was freely provided. We're talking about in Britain a period where medical care in civil life is paid for, but the military provides medical care provision in the form of medical officers and health assessments from the point of enlistment onwards. So while war was, as Simon Harold Walker has recently argued, hard on men's bodies, many men found that military training and indeed military service left them significantly fitter and stronger than when they'd entered the service. Servicemen themselves certainly felt that this was the case. So C. Foster had no doubt that the exacting discipline of military service has a most favourable effect on the body. While M. Holroyd boasted in a letter home that my chest has greatly expanded. I think the letter doesn't have a name on it, but I have a feeling he's writing to a female relative who's been knitting him sweaters, and he's pointing out that he can no longer fit into them. He's making this a boast. Servicemen in wartime, were prioritized. Despite these boasts, this is not to say that wartime medical encounters with healthcare were necessarily pleasant. Joanna Bourke notes doctors in wartime often acted more as detectives than as caregivers. They had a central role to play in identifying and preventing malingering, which was viewed as central to their role. Although it would be wrong to portray all military doctors as unsympathetic detectives, even kindly physicians found the pressures on them to police malingering too great. Like it or not, doctors as detective, the doctor's detective was under War Office authority and had to act unsympathetically. It's not just War Office authority, they are part of the military. Medical officers hold military rank temporarily during the war, and that puts them under certain obligations through military discipline as well. Wartime medical care could also be used coercively, as Alexia Moncrief has demonstrated in her discussion of the treatment of Australian servicemen for VD, where the unpleasantness of VD treatment is used as a way of attempting to dissuade men from engaging in inappropriate sexual practices, or dangerous sexual practices, I should say. But in spite of Leo van Bergen's argument that doctors were not motivated primarily by a desire to heal patients, but by the need to return sick and wounded men to the front, or at least the munitions factory, wartime medical care, as we've seen, could be viewed positively by servicemen and could be understood in the aftermath of war as a positive benefit. Fiona Reid, for one, has suggested that men came out of the trenches with the firm belief that because they had gone to war, they deserved good state-funded medical care and social care, not just during the conflict, but afterwards too. Reid is talking comparatively about Britain, France, and Germany. What I want to do today is to test this assertion in the British case, and to consider the extent to which wartime medicine shaped the social experience of care in Britain in the years after the war. So I'll do this through considering both the views of medical care provision articulated by disabled ex-servicemen in their personal pension files, as well as views of the state, or at least civil servants in the Ministry of Pensions, about who should be responsible for providing medical and social care to former servicemen. I will finish by identifying gaps in what this formal state archive can tell us, and some thoughts on where else we might want to look for bottom-up understandings of medical care provision. In doing this, I want to complicate the argument that's been put forward variously by Bourke, Winter, and Tracy Loughran, that medical knowledge and expertise developed during the war prompted an increase in the health of civil populations in the war's aftermath. Ambiguous attitudes towards medical intervention in individuals' lives served to limit the reach, I suspect, of medical welfare and innovation in the years immediately after the First World War. But as you'll see, that argument is still quite speculative, and I value any feedback on it. The view that state provision of what we might broadly define as healthcare was a duty owed to those whose service was compelled by mass mobilization and the patriotic requirements of national duty in total war has been traditionally applied to the socio-political response after the Second World War and the foundation of the NHS as part of the welfare state. However, as David Edgerton has noted, this standard account of the British welfare state, as originally articulated by Richard Titmuss in the 1950s, has increasingly been challenged by welfare historians such as Susan Pedersen and Bernard Harris. Their analyses have nuanced understandings of this foundation by asserting the importance of the First World War in particular to the origins of the welfare state. So there's a prehistory. Family allowances, instituted to encourage men to enlist and to maintain both military and civilian morale through the maintenance of working class living standards, served to foreground the question of child and infant health and welfare, bringing them firmly into the ambit of state authority. Dorothy Dwork has argued that this culminated in the Maternity and Child Welfare Act of 1918. The physical, sensory, and psychological damage wrought by war, meanwhile, combined with developments in medical science to make healthcare and disability a political priority. The perception of the duty of the state to care for men who had sacrificed physical and psychological health in its name not only led to the creation of the statutory right to a war disability pension, which came into effect in 1917 with the establishment of the Ministry of Pensions, but also underpinned the conversion of the Wartime Medical Research Council the Wartime Medical Research Committee to the Medical Research Council, which happens in 1920. So while disability pensions themselves were administered by the Ministry of Pensions, the Ministry of Health, which also comes into being in this period, it's established in 1919, has a wider remit in relation to the administration of medical welfare. It was responsible for local government, and it thus was responsible for the bulk of the complex system of social services, including pensions, health insurance, hospitals, the poor law and housing, as well as public officers of health. So anything health and welfare related, both military and civil, comes in some ways into the remit of the Ministry of Health, and trying to unpick what the Ministry of Pensions is responsible for versus what the Ministry of Health is for is one of those headaches of anybody who's worked with the archive. To what extent did such political and institutional developments affect individual experience, objective experiences of health, both good and ill, in the years after the war? Answering this question is challenging in spite of the increased levels of bodily surveillance that wartime bureaucracies developed and enforced, which means we actually have quite a lot of personal records of British servicemen in relation to their health. So while the great social historian of medicine, Roy Porter, famously argued that to understand the history of health and medicine, we need to lower our gaze from the top of the medical hierarchy to incorporate the patient's voice, trying to do so for patients during and after the First World War remains complicated. Georgia McWhinney has recently suggested that numerous studies attempt to unpack the power of wartime medical systems through doctors' experience and interactions with patients without ever really getting access to what the men themselves understood as good health, ill health and how to care for it. And McWinney's work looks at what she terms vernacular medicine in the trenches, the way in which things like chatting, swinging the lead even, could be seen as forms of health care, in their view. So while historians such as Anna Carden Coyne and Jeffrey Resnick have contributed important studies to this field in terms of men in hospitals and locating the patient voice in hospital contexts, the voice of the care provider tends to dominate, and that includes doctors and nurses and even the sort of care providers that I was looking at in my last book, the stretcher bearers and medical orderlies, but not the patients themselves necessarily. Histories of healthcare after the war, meanwhile, have tended to focus either on women's health and maternity care, or in the case of Bork's discussion of men's bodies, dismembering the male, have subsumed the impact of the war itself into longer term cultural phenomena such as the men's stress reform movement. This is my excuse for putting up one of my favorite images, which emerges in the late 19th century, although this is a 1920s image of a man in a skirt. The League of Health and Strength, which is founded in 1906 and in the interwar period becomes the Women's League of Health and Strength, or Eugene Sandow's popularization of bodybuilding. So the men's health and perceptions of health in Bork's analysis is part of a longer social movement that precedes and postdates the war, rather than she never quite, for all that her work is an analysis of wartime, men's bodies in wartime, somehow the men's perception of their health in war gets slightly lost in this longer term analysis. Part of the problem is Bork rightly notes in understanding the particular impact of war on men's perceptions of their own health or lack thereof, was ex-servicemen's desire to slough off their service identity as part of a post-war retreat to the home. They were civilian, the vast majority of British servicemen were civilian who mobilised for the term, their term of service was the duration of the war and not beyond that, and they returned to civilian identities after the war. And this has, as Bork points out, particular implications for men who undergo medical treatment due to disability during their war service. So according to the Liverpool Echo, ex-servicemen were fed up with discipline, sick of the sight of khaki and doctors, and their first idea was to get away and hide themselves. So these are men who are undergoing medical treatment during the war and then demobilised due to their health in 1917. As Amy Baker of Burley wrote in a letter to the Times, the one craving of each broken hero after all that he's gone through is to get back home to the wife and children or to the old mother if not married. So this removal from a military identity militates against men expressing how they understood their health in relation to war. Even if such men required health care after making this transition, their records where they seek medical engagement would identify them as civilians rather than in ex-service terms. The only category of men who this does not apply to, of course, are the disabled ex-servicemen who are in receipt of a pension, whose encounter with medical services is because they are seeking some sort of acknowledgement of attributability of their poor health to the war. To qualify for a pension, their poor health condition had to be assessed and acknowledged as attributable to their war service, and having permanently inscribed their relationship to the war on their identity through their health and the care, or lack of health and the care they received for it. So some of the records of this ongoing relationship with war are located in the personal pension files of disabled ex-servicemen, the National Archives, PIN 26, which I've been working on and which many of you will know, has 22,823 extant files of roughly 1% of all the files produced. Others were lost to water damage during the Second World War or were destroyed during a controlled burn in the 1980s. So these files contain a range of documents relating to men's medical assessments and care, often stretching over a number of years. And this is a very brief example. Each quarter, so each half of the page on this represents a separate medical assessment and the resulting pension awarded to that man following the medical assessments, and you get files with pages and pages of these renewal of awards, with each one of them representing a separate medical assessment that the man had to undergo. These usually happened yearly or 6 monthly until their claim was dismissed or they were awarded a gratuity or permanent pension. After 1921, in theory, the maximum period of receipt of a temporary pension was set at 4 years, although those on a permanent pension could still be regularly assessed for changes in their condition, particularly when they were in receipt of a high level of pension. The state continually wanted to make sure that if they could lower it, so no one would be called in for the assessment to see if they could change the level of pension. And even for men who only experienced reassessments for a short period up to the limit of 4 years, the regularity of such assessments was the source of complaint for these men who found the process intrusive, onerous, and inconvenient. Again, these were also men who wanted to hold on to a civilian identity at this point. They were no longer servicemen, yet they were still being treated as servicemen to some extent by the systems that kept on demanding that they be surveilled by the pensions bureaucracy. Ex-servicemen could also dispute the assessment of doctors. They lived with their disabilities. Doctors only saw them for short periods and captured a particular moment of their experience. And there was a lot of resentment about lack of recognition of the actual effect of disabilities on lived experience. This was more common among middle-class pensioners who had the sufficient social capital to challenge professional medical judgments. But it could occur among all pensioners, which is very much in the tradition that we see in the 19th century of poor law recipients who used letters of complaint to the poor law guardians as a way of making their voice as patients heard, which is something that Paul Carter and Steve King have looked at in quite a lot of detail in the MH106 files, which contain a lot of pauper patient letters of complaint. In terms of the First World War pensioner complaints, these complaints are most often seen in the personal letters to the Ministry of Pensions, which appear sporadically throughout the files. However, the bulk of the files are made up of official forms like the renewal and assessment form, which were generated both by the War Office. So almost all personal pension files contain men's war records, including their health records from their time of service, and also the Ministry of Pensions, which track their financial award and their health records after the war. So one reasonably common type of form are the records of hospital admissions. This is actually, and I've somehow managed to cut off the title of this, this is actually a termination of hospital care form. There are two forms that will go. One is the admission to hospital and one is the termination. It's about tracking the finance associated with a hospital admission. But men could be admitted either as an outpatient Which was most common for amputees who required stump care or adjustment to their artificial limb, or for temporary inpatient treatment, which was most often provided to them suffering from chronic and relapsing illnesses, such as malaria. Men could also be admitted for mental health care, and hospital stays in mental asylums, both temporary and permanent, are recorded in these forms. So as I said, the primary information on these forms is financial rather than medical. Hospital treatment brought men fully into the remit of the Ministry of Health, with their medical files held in a different section of the National Archives, which can be accessed, but cross-referencing with the pension files is almost impossible. So it becomes very difficult to actually trace an individual in terms of both their financial surveillance and their actual medical surveillance. Nonetheless, financial records can offer some insight into the return to health of ex-servicemen. Men admitted to hospital for treatment for their pensionable disability were automatically placed on full pension of 27 shillings sixpence per week, for which their hospital board and lodging was automatically deducted. This fact caused considerable frustration. Gail Kimball White, for example, in 1921, wrote to the ministry to complain of the unjustness of the deductions made for his hospital care because, quote, "I am a married man and have two children to keep and I'm entirely dependent on my pension." Campbell White, whose pension was for neurasthenia, also expressed his frustration at being sent for treatment in a different county. He was being sent to a specialist mental health institution, which was in Devon. His family were in Kent. And this made it extremely difficult for them to visit him. What Campbell White almost certainly didn't realize that this was that from a medical perspective, from his doctor's perspective, this was probably intentional. This was because such separation was in line with dominant medical opinion concerning the treatment of psychological traumas, and particularly things that were classified as neurasthenia, which advocated men's removal from the sympathetic environment of their homes, and isolation from friends and family who would pander to their feelings of helplessness. Unsurprisingly, in these circumstances, men felt a distinct lack of agency in relation to their health when undergoing ministry-funded hospital treatment. Care was provided in a form that suited the medical profession and dominant views of the medical profession, rather than the individual patient and his particular circumstances, domestic or otherwise. The financial documentation also exposes the elements of compulsion and surveillance that accompanied medical care associated with war service. Men were forced both to attend medical examinations and undergo specified hospital treatment under threat of losing their pension entirely if they refused. While in hospital, they were expected to submit to the authority of medical professionals, as well as others, and nor was the medical profession the only form of surveillance in hospital that affected men's bodily agency and economic independence. As Jeffrey Resnick has noted, many disabled soldiers also saw hospital work as a kind of charitable action. Comparable to being sent to the workhouse, this view became more pronounced in early 1917 when many local pensions committees were still sending disabled cases to the workhouse, despite the existence of regional orthopedic facilities. Even when this was not the case, disabled men and their families loathed government relieving officers who visited orthopedic hospitals, regarding them as the front doorstep to the workhouse. So men's encounters in hospital were not just with medical professionals, they were also with welfare professionals, the relieving officer, and that was a further step in denying them a sense of agency in these settings. So in spite of this lack of sense of agency that we can see through complaint and through these experience of hospital care, pensioners did retain a sense that state-funded medical care was their due, a payment for their sacrifice of health and consequent economic well-being. Campbell White may have disliked being sent long distances to receive hospital care from which the deductions for his pensions were made. But he also wrote to demand, why can I not get what is due to me? C. E. Evans similarly believed that the public would make a great outcry if the facts of my case were known to them, and I shall feel compelled to obtain help in a way which may cause publicity. I do not want charity. I want my rights. And that's, as I've argued in Men of War, you know, that tension between state-funded care and charity is at the heart of men's sense of their identity as ex-servicemen, as pensioners. Such expectations weren't only expressed in letters of complaint. They weren't necessarily articulated in such a way. The 9 folders which make up J.M. Marshall's file are almost entirely filled with receipts for repairs and parts for his wheelchair, medicine and medical supplies and regular massage therapy, all relating to the care he needed for paralysis. He was paraplegic, I think. A middle-class officer who appears to have been able to afford the initial outlay for medical care, the medical care he required, and then claim it back off the ministry, Marshall nonetheless viewed the cost of his care, something owed him by the state. He's absolutely meticulous in claiming everything back. And getting into where correspondence does turn up in his files, it's usually when there's a delay in repayment or something similar. By acquiring it on a reimbursement basis, he appears to have been able to assert agency in relation to his care. He gets to choose what he purchases and then claims back, which gives him more control over his care than Campbell White is able to exert in terms of the location of his treatment. Campbell White is also middle class, but seemingly has fewer economic resources, and the type of care he needs is different. So reduces his sense of agency in this situation. In pension files, therefore, the provision of medical care by the state comes across as an ambiguous benefit at best. Viewed by many as due payment for the sacrifice of health and earning capacity, the chronic illness and disability represented, the mode of provision could be a source of profound complaint. Some, like Marshall, had the social and economic capital to ensure that the system met their needs. However, for men without such resources, state-provided medical care could entail a loss of agency or even a sense of stigma through its association with charity and care provided by workhouse infirmaries through the association with the nascent welfare profession. Nor is class the only factor which skews pension files as a source of uncovering patient perspective on healthcare and the return to health after the war. These letters represent a self-selecting category of pensioner, those who are motivated to complain. As historians of welfare and petitions in earlier conflicts, the early modern and modern periods have noted, what archives capture are the instances where things go wrong or fail to live up to expectations. We have little way of accessing the views of those whose expectations of post-war care provided by healthcare were met, although occasionally evidence can be found. R.F. Williams writes to praise the hearing aid provided by the ministry, which allowed him to continue his work as manager at a hosiery firm in spite of being profoundly deaf in one ear. The engagement of disabled ex-servicemen with care and modification of state provided prosthetic devices is, as Corinne Maguire and Louise Bell have shown, one potentially fruitful avenue for further exploration of this more positive perception of state-provided care to expand our understanding of ex-service views, another source of the patient voice here. However, even with this expansion, the views reflected are of a particular category within the wider category of ex-servicemen, the pensionable disabled, which represents about 1.1 million men. Debates about how many men were actually disabled by war, but in terms of who the state recognized as being disabled, statistics suggest it was about 1.1 million British servicemen, but that's about, a little bit less than a quarter of the broader category of all ex-servicemen, which is what Graves and Hodge appear to be considering, and indeed Reid suggests in her argument. So how can we assess the wider picture of the non-disabled, or at least those not formally recognised as disabled, ex-servicemen and their return to health after the war? Because I think we do have to assume that men's health in wartime was changed by their war experience, some positively, some negatively, and a lot of it not necessarily captured by formal diagnosis. So part of the problem in the historiographies exists at the moment is that, as Helen Jones has noted, the discussion of public health in the interwar period has A, focused on the latter half of the period, and I know we're going to hear a bit more about that from Michael later, and the growing influence of eugenics and eugenicist thinking as areas of historical research and discussion. Welfare history perspectives have also focused attention on the importance of unemployment and poverty on the health of the nation in the wake of the Great Depression as a historical moment that has sparked historical debate. And the health of children has also been a particular focus because it was such an important subject for public health officials at this time as part of these eugenicist debates, and therefore shaped the inquiries of social historians since. For Jones, the key public health developments in the years between the wars, therefore, were the spread of birth control and family allowances. And this supports Susan Pedersen's analysis of the significance of wartime welfare developments as a gendered practice which brought women's welfare and children's welfare to the fore of public debate. And Jones suggests that historical considerations of health in Britain in the period need to focus discussion on the role of women. Women were the ones primarily responsible for promoting and maintaining health. Officials regarded this as the mother's role, and women who were not thought to be doing a good job of health and care were subjected to official condemnation. Yet when women's health suffered more than male members of their families, I think we might want to nuance that final assertion. But this idea of women, and particularly women as mothers, is relevant, I want to suggest, to our consideration of expectations around care provision for ex-servicemen after. So the belief that women were primarily responsible for promoting and maintaining health shaped the government's approach to provision of care to ex-servicemen. The home was understood as the primary and preferred site of care for those with recognised disabilities. Long-term institutional care was viewed as anathema to the British state, which underpins debates around the status of the service patient in mental health asylums, which Peter Barham discusses in Forgotten Lunatics of the Great War. The concern was not only that institutionalization of this sort would stigmatize rather than rehabilitate these men, which is where much of the political debate focuses. There were also less publicly articulated financial concerns. Helen Bettinson has demonstrated how the Treasury spent much of the early 1920s seeking to reduce pension liabilities for inpatient treatment in particular. Officials saw themselves confronted by an array of vested interests. Doctors had every incentive to interpret the need for treatment with extreme generosity as a matter of professional survival. Hospital management connived, for even if giving treatment was originally justified, it will tend to be unjustifiably prolonged by the reluctance of the hospital authorities to turn into a hard world a man who has nothing to go to. In addition, the ministry's own self, that's the Ministry of Pensions, own self-serving desire to retain it in its institutions. The Treasury identified the civil voluntary hospitals, the Labour Party, and the British Legion as further interested parties in this attempt to screw money out of the government, essentially, through institutionalizing men. From 1923 onwards, the Treasury sought to restrict access to care, particularly to the chronically disabled, who required long-term, if not lifelong, care. Treasury officials believed that the retention of chronic cases, such as paraplegics, Epileptics and borderline neurasthenics in ministry institutions was unnecessarily preventing their closure. They therefore pushed for their removal into a handful of specialist hospitals, with the remaining general cases to be dealt in with in civil institutions. Over the next few years, the rationalization of ministry hospital accommodation, as numbers under treatment fell, achieved the desired institutional closures. And this is an example of one of the specialist hospitals. This is Chapel Allerton Hospital, which opens in 1927. It is still under Ministry of Pensions control, but it is a vastly reduced number of men from what had been number 2 Northern General Hospital at Beckett Park and the East Leeds Workhouse. It's a split site in Leeds. And the LGI, the Leeds General Infirmary, takes over the majority of patients. The last, I think it's about 60 men. Are left in 1927 when Chapel Allerton opens, and that reduces up to the Second World War, at which point the hospital becomes Leeds War Hospital during the Second World War. So the War Office takes it over at that point. The result of this reduction in state-provided hospital beds was not necessarily an increased reliance on privately funded professional medical care. That is, men didn't necessarily move into private hospitals, but rather on domestic care provision. They go home. The shift was state policy, which can be seen in the award of constant attendance allowances and consequent discussion among ministry officials about their administration. Constant attendance allowances were paid to men in receipt of a full disability pension who were not in institutional care, but who nonetheless required assistance with their care. The very existence of such allowances indicates the importance of domestic care provision to the health care for ex-servicemen funded by the state after the war. The state was acknowledging right from the start that they were going to need to rely on domestic care to provide for these men. Then there was the fraught question of who qualified for payment as a constant attendant. Did family members count? Did their age, expertise, or domestic status in relation to the pensioner make a difference? If so, should this be reflected in the amount of allowance given? Should professional attendants be paid more than family members? What, if any, responsibility did the state have to familial care providers whose health was compromised by the strain of constant attendance on a man who had been disabled in the war? And there are examples. Marshall's wife suffers a breakdown in her health because of the strain of pushing her husband up the hills around the house in his wheelchair. These debates are predicated not only on the squeezed on budgets enforced by the Treasury, but also on the cultural assumptions that care in the home was both the preferred option of the majority of ex-servicemen and primarily the responsibility of family members, particularly women and girls. The men of the civil service debating the matter did not want to appear to be displacing the family as the primary source of care. This is a cultural assumption that was the family's role. Which I think is quite interesting in terms of the assumptions around the racial assumptions around care in the home that we discussed or that Donald was discussing earlier. However, the need to save money also precluded giving men and their families full agency over the allocation of the allowance in hiring suitable care. That is, the ministry wasn't willing to simply give men a constant attendance allowance and allow them to buy in whatever care they needed. There was a very strong sense that they needed to retain some sort of control over how the money was going to get spent. Various schemes for graduated allowances were put forward based on variables including gender, family relationships, and age. There's one very complicated scheme which involves a differential rate for a female family member under the age of 16 as constant attendant versus a trained nurse, which ends up not getting implemented, thankfully. Ultimately, the rates were set at a differentiated rate, but simply between a hired attendant versus a family member. So the question of gender and age is taken out to some extent. An attendance allowance could be paid in situations where wives and mothers were the primary caregiver, but it would only be awarded to provide respite care to prevent the breakdown in health of the primary caregiver. So if the wife or mother was, if the man needed 24-hour care for whatever reason, and there are certain men who do, then the constant attendance allowance was to pay for a night nurse as a professional caregiver in that situation. So these debates among ministry officials point to one of the central challenges in assessing the extent to which men's experiences of healthcare during the war shaped social attitudes towards care provision after, which is limited. From the perspective of state health, and healthcare was in this period for all the dominance of professional medical hierarchies, which had been professionalizing since the mid-19th century. Day-to-day care for those suffering ill health was very much the domain of women, but not necessarily the professional nurses. And the health of children and infant mortality remained the key measures of health and economic well-being of the nation as a whole. This helps to explain the state's focus in its interventions into civilian health and social care on improving nutrition for children and mothers, interventions which could be viewed as ambiguously as those to support disabled ex-servicemen. As Joanna Bourke has pointed out, increased bureaucratic intervention into private and familial lives was resented by working class households in this period. What welfare and demographic histories and the records of state institutions does not provide, however, is the insight into the influence that male ill health in these households had on how and how much healthcare was accessed or considered in the years after the war. And this is where I become very speculative and say I need to go and do more research, particularly looking at working class memoirs from the period, which are a key source for Bourke's work on working class culture, but which haven't really been exploited significantly in terms of thinking about the social legacies of the war in particular. What a welfare history approach to Reid's argument in relation to British men who emerged from the trenches does demonstrate, however, is that the demand for state intervention to aid the return to health was ambiguous. Disabled ex-servicemen may have viewed the care they received as a right earned through the sacrifice of their health and well-being in defence of the nation. The benefits that wartime welfare systems brought to family health may have been understood and appreciated. But the administration of care and aid was often perceived negatively, reflecting as it did the needs and priorities of the state rather than those of the individual recipients or their families. Which is not to say that men didn't take advantage of what healthcare was provided by the state. The desire to return to health and the sense of normalcy associated with physical and psychological function was a profound one. But to fully understand how men did this and the role that their families and communities played in this process, we do need to look, I think, beyond the disabled men whose voices are captured in state archives to family and oral histories, Michael Roper's work on his grandfather's medical experiences in the wake of war is a really good example of this recently. Mass observation reports, potentially diaries and autobiographies, where we may, I hope, find more information, however fragmentary, about the ways in which ex-servicemen and their families engaged with medicine, both formal and vernacular, in the pursuit of the return to health. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this History Hub podcast. History Hub is based at the School of History at University College Dublin. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, and on SoundCloud. For more information and to listen to hundreds of podcasts, go to historyhub.ie.